Welcome to the Bringing It to Life podcast series. This series looks at how practitioners and families can use the new National Best Practice Framework for Early Childhood Intervention. Our podcast today is being recorded on Jarjawarung country. We acknowledge the traditional custodians and recognise their continued connection to land, waters and community. We also pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Today's podcast is one of a series of conversations with families and practitioners from across Australia. We hope these conversations will help everyone understand what high-quality services and support looks like for children with developmental concerns, delay or disability, and how they can implement them in their practices every day.
Hello, my name's Kerry Bull, and you're listening to the fifth episode in our series of Bringing It to Life, National Best Practice Framework podcasts. Today, I'm pleased to be welcoming two guests who are keen to talk about child-centred approaches that focus on the individual needs and abilities of every child. Child-centred is one of the key principles of the National Best Practice Framework. This principle recognises children's right to learn, contribute, participate, and be safe in settings of everyday life, and to have a say in matters that affect them. It recognises the importance of children engaging in fun, play-based activities with peers, siblings, and adults. So welcome to Jackie and Mello. Firstly, Mello, who's based in New South Wales, a father of two children who also works in the disability sector and sits on a couple of reference groups. Hi, Mello, good to have you here.
Hello, glad to be here. Thanks, Kerry.
And Jackie, who's an early childhood teacher specialising in evidence-based inclusion practice. Jackie's based in Victoria and has extensive experience in early childhood intervention. Welcome, Jackie.
Thanks, Kerry. Great to be here.
We might start by hearing from you, Jackie. Can you tell us what a child-centred approach means to you?
Sure. Yeah, I guess in preparation for this podcast, I've been thinking, of course, a lot about child-centred approaches and reflecting back over my career, because it's a term I think I've used for the almost 40 years of working in early childhood, but it's meant different things over that time. And I think the child-centred approach is something that we do need to keep pulling apart. We need to continue to evaluate and really understand what it means as we learn more about how most effectively to work with young children in early childhood environments and, of course, support families. So I guess currently in the early childhood context, I think of the child-centred approach being really about creating flexible and responsive learning experiences for young children and viewing that each child in that group is part of informing how we create those flexible and responsive experiences. So we're viewing children in a holistic sense. We're looking at them as a whole person and also thinking about them in an ecological sense. So thinking about who they are within their family, what's important to that family, and what we know about their culture and their experiences and how they see the world, and how that child and family relate to their community and society more generally. So I guess we also contribute to that by creating community within early childhood programs, and particularly do that through the facilitation of peer interactions. So it's not only about children on their own, it's about children connecting together, and it's about the environment and ensuring that we're observing and responding in a really nimble way. And I guess the other really important part that I've been thinking a lot about lately and is very much related to my current work is how critical relationships are in ensuring that we get that child-centred approach right. And I guess we've always thought about our relationship with young children and really getting to know who they are individually and getting to know the group. But I think that we are much better in current times at really thinking about our relationships as a team within the early childhood environment, that we really trust and know each other well. And we're really clear about our shared pedagogy so that we are able to really support each other in that flexible and responsive way. And we can only do that when we have strong relationships with one another. And then, of course, that filters through to families in the community. But being that most important element of ensuring that we're creating an environment that really values relationships. And then when we've got all of that right, I guess to bring it back again to the environment of early childhood, we're able to then embed learning within those play-based, those flexible and responsive learning experiences. We're able to ensure that those experiences are relevant and meaningful to the individuals, and that we're able to provide them in a flexible enough way that kids are doing things in different ways and at different paces and pursuing their own interests. And that then allows the adults to be able to observe and respond with intentional teaching opportunities. And that's all really, really complex. So I think that when I think about child-centered approach, we've thrown around this term for a long time, but it's really deep and complex and something that we continue to learn about.
Thank you, Jackie. You've really set the scene beautifully for us and picked up on so many important elements. Thank you. That's terrific. And we might turn to you, Mallow, and particularly as a dad, Mallow, can you talk with us about your interest in child voice and agency and what that means to you?
Thank you. And thanks, Jackie. There was a number of points. I was just jotting a few things down. Child voice and agency. Look, if I rewind a few years, I have to say it meant nothing to me. I didn't know what they were. And the first bit of exposure I had to these concepts was actually in terms of parental agency. And I didn't know what that was. And I'm going to circle back to that in a moment and referencing just some of the things that Jackie has talked about. If we start with child voice, which I feel is vital, and for me, child voice is the foundation of building into a child's agency, to grow into their agency, to have confidence in their voice. And we shouldn't get stuck in the semantics of the word either, because it really is about children expressing themselves. So you can be non-verbal and still have a voice. So child voice for me is about giving children experiences where they're able to flex their mental muscle about making choices, about having decisions, making decisions, and through that building their confidence and their sense of self. I've come to realise that child voice and agency is actually something that I'm hearing a lot about in the disability sector now. Actually hearing a lot about it also in mainstream school settings in terms of child voice and agency. I've come to realise that child voice begins at home. It begins at home with very simple things like, what would you like for breakfast? Would you like cereal or toast? You know, what would you like to wear this Saturday? You know, these runners or that? This top or that? What would you like? So giving children a choice and giving them a range of things that you're happy for them to choose, whatever it might be. And it's this whole development via stealth of building their confidence and giving them this belief in being able to, instead of them getting it, you know, 8, 10 or what, and you're asking them, you know, go on, don't be shy, answer the question. And so these little things that then feed into and go into this concept of agency. And I'd like to throw in another word and go back to your parental agency, which is, I believe, really strongly linked to child agency. As parents, my experience is that we all have heard about and know about advocacy, but very few parents know about agency. And so advocacy, you know, speaking up for someone. And For me, agency is about standing up for somebody and then using the influence of your actions and the choices and decisions that, that you make to be able to influence outcomes. And when we think about child voice, child agency, my thinking has always been, how can a parent support a child's agency if they're not aware of their own? And so that notion of child voice and the things that we do really have having a positive impact. If this sense of parental agency, for example, is something that no one can take away from you, it's only ever going to be yours, but parents may not be aware of it or not even realize that they've giving it away, for want of a better description, in those early years where you're dependent or reliant on other people to support your parental journey. So for me, it's about, and it's, sometimes it's silly, even as I'm explaining it, this notion of, as mum or dad, you are the difference that's going to make the most difference in your child's developmental journey. And one of the best ways I've ever had it explained to me is to view yourself as the CEO of an organization called The Success of Your Child. And to see yourself as a modern day CEO, not the person that's banging the table like, you know, maybe 30 or 40 years ago, but modern day CEOs get everyone, and just referencing what Jackie was talking about, getting everyone in the team, in the organization, to come together to follow the vision that you have. So the goals that you have and the vision that you have for your child. So yeah, for me, that they're huge.
Yeah, thank you. You've really helped my understanding of this link between parental agency and child agency, Mallow. Thank you for that. I'm going to turn back to you, Jackie, if you don't mind, because I want to pick up on something you were talking about, is about interactions. Can you talk about the opportunities for children to develop positive interactions with family and friends?
I love that idea of families viewing themselves, or what parents viewing themselves as a CEO of their family, and, you know, what that means in terms of what they want to achieve collectively, and that oversight that parents can have on enabling all of those opportunities to come into fruition, which, when you think about yourself as a CEO, I think it ensures that you're thinking about that we're really maximising what that's going to look like for our family in the direction that we want to do it. Mm-hmm. And I guess that beautifully underpins this idea of why those interactions within a family are so important, because, of course, for a CEO to be effective, you've got to really understand the needs and wants and desires of the people within your family. And I guess, you know, we know, even when we think about children's, if we're optimising each child's development and positive health and wellbeing outcomes in the future, it really starts with what parents are able to offer. And we know that, of course, not every parent has all of the right grounding themselves and the right circumstances to be able to provide all of those opportunities their child, and therefore, but they're still capable. They're still capable of being able to do the best they can and be the CEO according to their desires and what they can see that they're going to achieve. And I guess that brings back to the idea of attachment with parents and young children, how important that is right from the beginning, and how disruptive that can be when things come up within a family and you're taken in another direction. And I guess, as Kerry mentioned earlier, I've worked a lot in early childhood intervention, and so much of that work is really about how we strengthen and see the aspirations of the family and help to create, build on the strengths that are already there and those interactions that are important. And when we start from being able to strengthen all of those opportunities within a family, we know that that sets young children up to believe in themselves, to be open to that responsiveness that I talked about in early childhood environments, which is often about that attunement with parents, that they're noticing and they're tuning into what their child is wanting to do and responding to that. So all of those relationships are just crucial for how resilient the child is going to be as they move into new environments, and how open they are to new relationships. If they're grounded in strong relationships with their family, they're much more likely to be able to broaden those relationships with people within those new environments that they enter into throughout their childhoods and adolescence. So I guess, you know, I see that those interactions from a family level, critical. And working in the early childhood field, I think the frameworks help us to understand how we enact those strong collaborative relationships with the family, how we centre our practice and develop skills to be able to really build on that. And as it links back to child-led interactions, it's also critical to really understand who that whole child is, to really understand how that family has developed those interactions and how we can then build upon them rather than starting all over again in a new direction.
As you talk about that, Jackie, thinking about how you first introduced yourself and this topic of child-centered approaches and that things have changed over the 40 years of your career. And part of that, I'm thinking, is that the science has helped us understand about the importance of the interactions you're now talking about, the experiences and interactions and the impact on child development. Yeah, absolutely. What a rich discussion. Got anything to add to what Jackie was saying there?
Do you know, in terms of secure attachment, so I deliver a training in secure attachment and emotion coaching, and it's really, really interesting. And exactly what you were talking about now, Kerry, in that these are areas where there's decades of research that are underpinning the messages that we're trying to get through. I didn't see my daughter fully, sad to say, that, you know, as much as some wonderful things have been happening and continue to happen in the disability sector, the first thing that needed to change was me. And so I was stuck in that medical model of just seeing all the things that she couldn't do. So I needed, and I think just a moment ago, intentional teaching, I think Jackie talked about. And I talked to parents about having conscious awareness about how you're seeing this moment and how you're actually supporting your child through these moments. Easy to say, not so easy to always do, because again, we've got other things that might be triggering us or influencing the things that we're doing. But relationships, it's just, you know, I often talk to parents about, could you please bring a sense of curiosity and possibility? You know, we're sharing, as I said a moment ago, we're sharing information that is supported in science with decades of research. This is not just about a few things that sound good. It's actually things that work for many people. Now, there is no one size fits all. However, there is data that suggests that these frameworks work, and you might need to modify them, adjust them for your situation, your family, and your child. So, yeah. So, for example, secure attachment, which sometimes some people think, what do you mean secure attachment? I love my child. It's about creating an environment for your child, actually, to have secure attachment with you, knowing that they can trust and rely on you in ways that builds that attachment. And that's the foundation of then moving into those emotion coaching conversations as they get older, because of the experiences that they've had of us being there with them, for them, through some of their struggles and meeting their needs as they're younger. And as they get older and these challenges get bigger, they'll continue to turn in towards us.
Mello, I love the words you've used, curiosity and possibility. That's something for me to be thinking about. Mello, you mentioned that you're doing emotion coaching. And I know that you're doing that in your role as a peer leader. Can you just explain to us what a peer leader is?
Sure. So a peer leader, peer worker is somebody that works in the area that they have a lived experience in. And so I've been delivering parenting programs, leadership programs into the disability sector for a number of years now. I've been fortunate. I've delivered them in different parts of the world. And the one constant that we all have is the love that we have for our children. And this notion of not realizing for some reason that in this environment of needing experts in our children's lives, we've almost forgotten that we're experts too. No one knows our children like we do. No one spends the amount of time that we do with our children. And so That notion of agency and trusting yourself, the way that, you know, if your gut's telling you something doesn't feel right, then more than likely there might be something in that. And again, then just getting parents to go back into that, whether it's the CEO of an organization called The Success of My Child, or just being more participatory in the relationships that they're having. You know, I thought I was a good father running around doing all these appointments with my daughter, but didn't realize that I wasn't as engaged as I should be. And when that changed, I not only became a better parent for my daughter, I became a better parent for my son. Now, whether it's secure attachment or emotion coaching or sharing anything with a parent, especially in the disability sector, a peer worker, for some reason, and well, because of the lived experience, we tend to connect with each other in ways that we might not even connect with other family members. You know, there may be extended family that don't get us in the way that someone with a lived experience does. And so in sharing information, that rapport that seems to be there opens up a parent's mind to things like hope and possibility and having a curiosity to try something on for size, knowing that A, they don't have to reinvent the wheel on their own. Others have traveled this path and they're getting this relationship from somebody that sort of gets them. And peer workers have been really, really successfully utilised in the mental health sector for decades. So the disability sector is catching on.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Thank you for that explanation, Mello. That's terrific. I want to hear from you again, Jackie, about something you mentioned earlier, and that was about children's strengths and their preferences. Can you talk a little bit about that for us and about how that supports better outcomes?
Sure. I guess in considering children's strengths and interests, we're going back to that idea of viewing every child individually. We're also viewing every child as a capable learner. And we also, and even reflecting back on what you were saying, Mello, about what we continue to learn about as parents as well, that we continue to learn and change throughout our lives. And I guess keeping in mind that young children, and even through their relationships at home and then in their early childhood environments and at school, their brains are continuing to connect and grow. And that's where, you know, as we get to know children in different environments, we're able to see their individual strengths and interests grow and develop with them. So I guess it's also, when we think about strengths and interests, it's not also defining children by some of their initial strengths and interests, because sometimes we can, particularly when we're supporting a child with a developmental delay or a disability, we can, of course, be focused on strengths, but then we start to define them and limit them through the strengths that we initially see. So I guess we need to continue to view strengths and interests as something that is very fluid and that can relate to all areas of their development and integrate within all sorts of learning experiences. And the child within their community at preschool or kindergarten or school, their strengths and interests will overlap with their peers' strengths and interests, but they might be exploring those in very different ways. So I guess what we're always attempting to do is really continually view the child to be able to see what they see through their eyes. And that involves, I think, for us as educators to be constantly checking ourselves for biases. I'm noticing this a lot in my own practice, that sometimes I will see a child show interest in something and I'll shape it in a direction that I think is going to be helpful for them to learn about or to know, and it might relate to someone else's learning. Now, elements of that are really helpful, but also we can be really limiting, actually, and taking it in a direction that's maybe not that child's full intention. So when you were talking about that space, Mello, of curiosity and possibility and positivity, that relates so beautifully to how we see children's interests. We're not limiting how we see them and using our prior experience to guide them. We're staying in that curious space and trying to approach our work with a mindset of learning ourselves that if we're viewing the child as a capable learner, we're embracing the opportunity to be a capable learner with them and to be constantly willing to be surprised by what they're showing us.
One of the things that interests me about what you were saying there, Jackie, was about the overlapping interests of children and their peers and how we can support peer interaction. And so I might throw to you, Mellow, if I can, and ask about how important is it for you as a dad that your daughter has been able to participate with her peers when she was a little girl and now that she's making the transition to high school, I think?
So she started high school this year. It's a brave new world for us. But again, relationships. And if COVID's taught us one thing, it's that relationships are vital. So this sense of connection and being with your peers is, I don't even know how we measure it. I can give you a couple of examples. Firstly, one of the things that I've now come to realise is this little saying that I have when I talk about Victoria in an education setting is, I don't want you just to include Victoria, I want you to involve her. And I think that this is really at the heart of, again, this sense of connection and making a child feel good about themselves, because they're not just there on the side, but they're there and participating in some way. We realised the power of peers. So Victoria had a peg for 7 years. She was tube fed for 7 years, and it took us quite a while to incorporate oral feeding with Victoria. We had a message from school one day, and the message was, could you please put some yogurt in Victoria's bag in the morning, because she's taking the other kids' yogurt. And we were like, but she's not even eaten yet. And so it was like excitement for us that she's eating, and then also a bit sad that our efforts at home weren't achieving anything, but seeing her peers eat at school was the motivation that she needed to really then take that step to show an interest in food. At school, her just wanting to be involved. So school for Victoria, the academic side of things is less important to us. It's still important, but the social interaction that she has with her peers and what she gains from that is really what drives us. It even happened at home. She sees her brother throwing and flipping a bottle, and before we realise, Victoria's doing it as well. She's at school and saw her one day and she's spinning the skipping rope. Now, I would not have thought that that was something that would have been possible for Victoria, and I don't know how much longer getting her to do some things would take if it was just on her own. The impact on peers, and just saying, I think, Jackie, you were talking about also, I think earlier, where not only are our children who might have challenges benefiting from being in these settings, but so are the other children. Mm-hmm. The other children are learning more about kindness and empathy and understanding because our children are more visible. So it sort of strips away some of the uncertainty, which is generally if they're unfamiliar with seeing a child with a disability, then they're not going to know how to be with children with disabilities. So the benefits of this are amazing. And the power of peers is both amazing and also beautiful. You know, we underestimate the connections that can be made. Jackie was talking about a child-centred approach. And now, no one questions the power and importance and value of early intervention for children. But where's the early intervention / support for parents? So they're seeing their children more fully. So when you're thinking about a child-centred approach, then the parent isn't stuck in all the things that their child can't do. And when you talk about strengths and interests, it's not met with silence like it was with me, because all I could think about was, what do you mean strengths? I have to do everything for Victoria, and I was stuck in all the things that she couldn't do, oblivious to all the things that everyone else could see that she could. And so a better way of educating parents to move out of that deficit medical model and into possibility, hope, and really embracing their agency so some greater outcomes can happen quicker.
Let's talk about outcomes then. That's a beautiful segue for us, Mello. I'm interested to hear from both of you about what child-centered practice looks like when it's working well and what's the impact, what's the outcomes we can expect. Do you want to take the lead on this one, Jackie?
Sure. I guess the outcomes and what it looks like is children who are engaged and purposeful and get meaning from the experiences that they're involved in, that they see themselves, you know, before I was talking about educators seeing children as capable learners, but that they start to develop that view of themselves and look for new opportunities to continue to broaden their capabilities going forward. So I think when we see it working well, we see that sometimes problems arise, but there's an approach that will attempt to resolve issues, keeping in mind the complexity of all of the issues and thoughts and views that are present.
Thanks, Jackie, and thanks in particular for raising parent or family outcomes as well as child outcomes, because, of course, any conversation about child-centered practice needs to be considered within the context of a child within a family. So it's great that you raised that. What about you, Mello? What do you see when child-centered practice is working well?
Just adding on to what Jackie just shared, which was fantastic, for me, I would include also seeing that there's elements of fun. And so when there's elements of fun, then you know that you're probably closer to that, you know, strength slash interests. And an example I often share with people, you know, they did say Victoria would probably not talk. We knew that she was interested in talking and communicating in some way. We tried AAC devices that seemed like hard work, so we invested the time into seeing how she might go. She loved singing, even though she wasn't able to articulate any words effectively, but she loved music and singing, and she would, you know, the humming, and then the sounds came. And so Cat was hard work, and you wouldn't have Victoria stick with those things. Devices were hard work. Music was not. And so even though I would get sick of playing and singing Twinkle Twinkle, she didn't. And so I continued to do that. And we would do and sing other songs. Victoria sings in English. She sings in Vietnamese. One of her carers is Vietnamese. They've got a beautiful relationship. And she sings in Greek. She sings songs that I had to learn because she was singing them with the connection that she had with my mum. And so incorporating fun into an activity means that in my daughter's case, 15 seconds could end up being 20 seconds, and 20 seconds would then build into 50 seconds, would build into a minute, three, five, etc. And that's all we need. You know, I measure things not on the outcome. I measure things on progress. I measure things on, you know, the level of resistance that we're getting. Because the other thing about this is needing to adjust and modify. Reflect, you know, as Victoria is developing, and you know, I need to ask myself, is it time for us to move a little bit further down the track? Is it time to just stretch her a little bit more? Always conscious not to strain, but wondering how might we stretch her a little bit more. So fun would be the number one thing that we would incorporate.
Yeah, well, I reckon fun's probably a pretty good place for us to close this conversation. What a lovely way to do it. And I'm glad that word came up, Mello. Thank you. Thank you to you both. This has been a really enriching conversation. I think a really reflective one for me. So thank you both for your time and expertise. It's been great meeting you, Mello, and see you again, Jackie.
Thanks, Kerry. Thanks, Jackie.
Thanks, Kerry. Yeah, thanks, Mello. Really enjoyed the conversation too.
Nice.
Jackie provided us with a thoughtful approach to considering responsive interactions, nurturing and stable relationships, secure attachment, and rich learning experiences in the early years of a child's life as laying the foundations for positive developmental outcomes such as self-confidence, motivation to learn, emotional regulation, and friendship with peers. Mello's personal accounts enriched the conversation and, amongst other things, provided insight into our growing understanding of approaches to support the voice and agency of children with disability and how that relates to parental agency. The interaction with other principles of the best practice framework was evident throughout. Listen to the first episode of the Bringing It to Life podcasts on the rights-based principle and the sixth episode on the family-centered principle to hear more from parents and practitioners.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of the podcast series for the new National Best Practice Framework for Early Childhood Intervention. The University of Melbourne acknowledges the contributions of its collaborators in developing this material for the framework, which was commissioned by the Department of Social Services. Collaborators include Healthy Trajectories, the Melbourne Disability Institute, Strong Kids, Strong Future, professionals and researchers in early childhood intervention, the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, SNAKE, National Voice for Our Children, Children and Young People with Disability Australia, and ACD, Advocating for Children with a Disability. The podcast content was produced by Precy. The work is copyrighted to the University of Melbourne under a Creative Commons licence. Credit must be given to the creator. Only non-commercial use is permitted, and no derivatives or adaptations are permitted. This material contains or draws upon Indigenous cultural and intellectual property contributed by SNAKE, National Voice for Our Children, and its staff, and is used with their consent. Dealing with any part of the materials containing Indigenous cultural and intellectual property for any purpose that has not been authorised by the custodians is a serious breach of customary laws. You must handle the Indigenous cultural and intellectual property accordingly when exercising the Creative Commons licence. Thank you for listening.